Yeah. So you have sources for physician aid in dying. What I want to do is this is not intended to be an overview or the official line on like Jewish approach to medical aid in dying. It's meant to address one issue within the field, and through that you'll actually end up picking up a lot of really important the primary pieces. So what we'll do is we'll introduce it for 10-15 minutes right now, look at just one source, and then we'll have time for Seder, because I'm going to build up what the question is. You'll look at the sources, and then we'll have Shir on that issue. Basically, first of all, is background. So medical aid in dying, physician aid in dying, truth is, the way you say that phrase already, you're going to know pretty much what the person thinks about the issue based on the words they choose. Because generally speaking, I mean, some might just not be informed, but generally speaking, those who oppose it refer to it as physician-assisted suicide. That's usually meant to make it look negative. And those who are not in opposition tend to refer to it as physician aid in dying or medical aid in dying. It's oftentimes just the semantics. You can already tell the perspective of it. It's legal now in 11 states. So I'm in California. It became legal in 2016, in June 2016. It's now 11 states. So this year, we know this year is a big election. It's already actually in state legislatures in 20 states this year. It tends to be, generally speaking, blue states, more liberal states that allow it. And it's usually a pattern, to be honest, that you can see in terms of bodily autonomy and state laws, whether that has to do with reproductive rights, abortion, gender-affirming care, or physician aid in dying. Oftentimes, they come together. So, I mean, you can decide for yourself. You can think about if that makes sense or not. The truth is, in California and every state where it's legal, even though it's legal in the state, there actually are a lot of parallels with abortion. Not necessarily, I'm not talking necessarily medically, but I'm saying with how it's legal. Because since Roe versus Wade fell, now the way the law works is that, like, federally it's not necessarily legal, but states can permit it. So for example, in California, at VA hospitals, which go by federal law, physician aid in dying is not allowed. Whereas in other hospitals, it is allowed except for Catholic hospitals. Catholic hospitals have their own rules, and they don't allow it. It's interesting. Catholic hospitals are now 30% of American hospitals, and in many places, and I'm not saying this necessarily say anything negative, I did my doctorate at a Catholic hospital at Loyola. They do incredible work in caring for the most vulnerable and the poor, and they build hospitals in places where there's no other hospitals. That also means that you oftentimes have places where you have no access to interventions that they don't allow unless you go for hours and hours, sometimes plane flights away. And so Catholic hospitals don't allow it. So in our hospital, we had a big debate. You know, we're a Jewish hospital. And we did debate, should we allow, once it was going to become allowed in California, should we allow it? We debated it a lot. I'll tell you more about it maybe when we come back together after you learn the sources. But I will tell you that since it's been legal, it's happened 4 times in hospitals in our state. 3 out of 4 were in our hospital. So, interesting.
I guess they said yes.
Yeah, I guess they gave away the ending already. No, but yeah. The truth is, it became legal in, this is going to be relevant, I'll just share it later, became legal in June 2016. In May 15th, 2016, is when we had our first request. Why did we get a request May 15th when it didn't become legal until June? Because the way the law worked in California was that there had to be a 15-day waiting period from the first request until it could be carried out. And some people were so anxious for it to become legal and so excited for it to become legal that they made their request 15 days before it became legal so that on the day it would become legal, they could engage in physician aid in dying. And so we had our first request already before it was even legal. It shows you something that we'll talk about later about attitudes towards it. We'll discuss, but keep that in mind. We've had people who have had surgeries in order to stay alive for those 15 days, meaning they were dying. They had procedures to keep themselves alive so that they would be able to do it themselves. Also, we'll analyze that. But something just to think about. What's in the psyche? Why is that a reality? But it is an important reality. I had a question. This has been a new thing to us. I remember being asked by a patient. I was asked to see a patient. I went up to the room. He says to me, "Rabbi, I need to see you. I have a question. Is there a day of the week that's better for the funeral? I'm planning my funeral. I want to know if there's a certain day of the week that's better, and I need your guidance." So I said, "I don't know. Is there a day that's better? I don't know. I mean, it's an academic question because we can't choose the day of our funeral. You know, usually we bury pretty quickly, and you know, we never know exactly when we're going to die." He says, "Oh no, I know. I'm planning it, and I'm already inviting my family, and I'm trying to choose like when's the best day to do this because I'm ready to do it." I remember just being like, "Okay, I hadn't thought about that. It was new to me. That was a new question."
Isn't it there that you shouldn't be doing all the preparations before the person is dead?
That's a different issue. Right, all right, okay. Yes, but he wanted to be prepared. So what I want to do with you now is let's just look at one of the sources, and this is going to build up the question that will then be the question that I'm going to let you look at sources for, because like I said, I'm not going to tell you necessarily, what does Judaism say about physician aid in dying? That's not the point of this, and that's not my goal with this. It's to share with you one big question that I received. Those are a couple questions that were like surprising. I want to share with you one question that threw our whole community for a loop, and I want to build it up before, and then I'll let you research it. You can even research it on I'll give you the question. I'll give you some sources that I found. Maybe you'll find some other sources, and we'll come back together and discuss them.
I'm still confused.
Josh,
can you clarify the difference between physician aid in dying and euthanasia?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually, because in Canada, euthanasia is legal. In America, physician aid in dying is legal. Oftentimes, those who oppose, and I'll tell you the difference, oftentimes, those who oppose either of these refer to Canada as being worse. Because in America, the way it works is that a doctor has to prescribe, and it is a doctor. That's something that's actually being challenged now. But it has to be a doctor that prescribes something that the patient themselves have to self-ingest. They request once from one doctor, then 15 days later, and I said was in the past tense before because now in California and also Oregon, it's now 2 days. It's not 15 days anymore. It's been reduced to 2 days. There's the first request, second request, and then the patient, by law, has to take. It ends up being like a medicine they drink, and they have to drink it themselves. That's physician aid in dying because the physician makes the prescription, the patient ingests themselves. That's why it's medical aid, right? In Canada, it's called euthanasia because a doctor, or not necessarily a doctor, a technician, actually ingests the patient with this drug that ends their life. So it's being done by the medical professional that ends the patient's life. So that's why euthanasia is slightly different than physician-assisted because the physician is doing it for them. Now, people who oppose this say, look, it's a slippery slope, and look how much worse Canada is because it's actually the doctors are killing the patients. I'm giving the argument. The doctors kill the patients, and you see, even in Canada, it's much higher numbers. It's happening more frequently, and this is a slippery slope to doctors deciding who they don't think's life is worth living and them just ending people's lives. This is the argument. Many Canadians make the opposite argument. They argue that their approach is much better. In fact, I remember when we were researching this, and I'll share a lot of this when we come back together, we really, in our hospital, took this seriously because it was like a big thing when it became legal. It was very new to us, and it was like, how are we going to deal with this? And there was a lot of questions that arose for doctors, for patients, for all of us. And we brought in a lot of speakers also, especially from those who had more experience. Oregon has been legal for 30 years already. They were the first in America. Canada, they have a different approach, but they have a lot of experience. We brought in Canadian speakers. And one, we're a Jewish hospital, but it's like, let's say, Mount Sinai in Manhattan. It's not like everyone's Jewish there, or even everyone who's Jewish is observant by any means. But I remember this speaker from Canada got up and she said to us, our approach in Canada is much better than yours in California. Ours promotes pikuach nefesh. We were like, how does that pikuach nefesh? So their argument, first of all, there's two claims why they actually argue that euthanasia is morally superior to physician aid in dying. Two claims that I'm aware of. Maybe there's more. They argue, first of all, one claim that came up in California since it became legalized was from disability rights advocates. They argue, by forcing the patient to self-ingest, you're now limiting. There's a lot of people who have terminal illnesses. The law is a patient has to have a terminal illness by which they're expected to die within 6 months. That's the same to be legally allowed to enroll in hospice. Same rules. So the patient has a terminal illness. Obviously, they're very sick. And for them to be able to ingest by hand, first of all, one of the common, this came up yesterday, one of the very common illnesses that people choose to engage in physician aid in dying is ALS. I think I just heard someone say it. It's ALS. ALS, people lose the capacity to use their hands at a certain point. So many disabilities rights advocates argue that this is discriminatory. Why should someone, if it's going to say it's legal, why should it only be legal to those who have use of their hands or their mouths? Because there's been people that tried to use a straw and they weren't able to. Also, this woman, this professor from Canada, when she argued that it promotes Pequot Nefesh, she said, look, in California or anywhere in the 11 states in America and more soon where it's legal, the patient has a terminal illness and they know what's coming. So they decide, I don't want to go through all of that. So, and I don't want to get to a point where I'm totally indignified and suffering. And so I better do it especially if I have to do it myself, I better do it sooner than later before I lose the opportunity. But in Canada, they can simply tell us, she argued, you know, when I get to X or Y point, then do it. But until then, I don't know how long it's going to be. I'm going to try to live a life of fulfillment until then. And when I get to that point, if you see that I'm, you know, at this or that point, then please do it for me. And she argued that people therefore live longer in Canada than they do in the States because they can, like, give it more of a shot, so to speak.
Susan, did you have a question?
Yes.
Mostly answered already, but the technical piece around if you can't do it yourself and somebody else has to help you, does that count?
In California, they get really nervous about anyone helping in any way. Uh-huh. Because is it murder? I mean, oftentimes it happens in people's homes and it's very private, but you hear people share their stories that, like, the patient was asking for help and they didn't want to help because they didn't know if that's considered murder or whatever, you know, probably isn't, but technically they have to do it completely themselves.
How strict is it?
Leah. Sorry.
Hey, Leah. How strict is it when it's happening in California that someone is standing to make sure the patient takes it?
It doesn't have to be. They can get the prescription and go home and do it by themselves. Now, usually, almost like something like 96% of the time in California, the patient is on hospice. And there's hospice staff with them at that time. In our hospital, when it's happened, there's been staff and chaplains with them at that time.
What would you be your argument against what the professor said? When I get to this point, I want you to do it.
Well, I don't know if I have an argument, but the counter argument often is, you know, when patients are very vulnerable, the argument like that Dr. Prager made yesterday and that many physicians make is like, this isn't the role of a physician. Our role is to be healing. Some argue that, you know, vulnerable patients putting so much power in the hands of someone who might not, you know, have the same concern about their lives because you know, if you talk about patients who are very vulnerable and maybe don't have the same socioeconomic access, could there be a slippery slope? That's some of the concerns. There was a presumption that if the patient doesn't themselves, they're clearly choosing. Their autonomy is most respected because they're making that choice. Whereas if someone's doing it to them, could you worry about a patient who's not totally conscious, who wasn't making the decision totally clearly? That's some of the counter argument.
And it's only if it's a terminal illness.
In America. In Canada, it's not clear. They have ambiguous language in the law intentionally. It used to say something like, has a reasonable likelihood of dying, which was sort of everyone has. There was a lot of ambiguity there, and they changed it a little bit. But it's in America, that's one of the safeguards, is that they have to have a terminal illness. In Canada and the Netherlands, places like that, it's a little bit grayer.
I'm asking because my mom at some point, and that's why I got confused, 2018, she has no use of her hand. She's in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
Someone has to
right.
assist her with everything. She just said to my sister, I've had it.
Uh-huh.
They're in L.A.
Uh-huh.
But she didn't call the
call. Oh, so you must have not had it. Right.
Is
right.
Very disabled.
Right. That's one of the differences. Yeah.
Sarah is waiting. And then you, Sarah, please.
I'm wondering if there's any data or even anecdotal cases collected of like how this is being utilized in states where it's legal as opposed to other methods that patients might take upon themselves, right? Like either withdrawal of care or refusing things like hydration and feeding tubes or, you know, like methods of suicide outside of the medical realm.
Yeah.
I would assume there's some patients who are only willing to do it within, you know, medical aid in dying and some patients who attempt other methods. And I'm wondering if it's just like this is a more, you know, humane and monitored method, or it's also that patients, like there's something about having the, almost the doctor's permission. The doctor is saying it's okay for you to want to do this.
Well, there is data. We have been watching it very closely, and it's been increasing a lot. And what we've noticed is that it was indeed happening before it was legal. There was, for example, something called VSED, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, that patients were, you know, colluding, so to speak, with their physicians to increase their pain medications, and then they would stop eating and drinking, and they would end their lives that way, or otherwise withdrawing life-sustaining interventions. And there does seem to have been an increase since it's become legalized because people feel like it's safer and more direct, that they don't have to kind of use these workarounds. And we're seeing that those other methods like voluntarily stopping eating and drinking is declining, whereas while physician aid in dying is increasing. We are noticing, though, that we've been watching the data very carefully. One of the concerns before it was legalized was, would the most vulnerable members of society be exploited? Would they be victims? That was a big concern. It has turned out to be...
In what way would they be?
Because if someone doesn't have insurance... I mean, I could tell you a brief story. We had someone come to our ethics committee who was an oncologist who... There was a woman who was living in L.A., but she did not have citizenship. She went to a county clinic. She was diagnosed with cancer. That type of cancer, that clinic told her that there was no treatment for it. They gave her the option of aid in dying. She said, that's better than what you're describing to me. But they had to have a second physician sign off. The physician who she was sent to sign off is a specialist in that type of cancer. And when she came to his office, he said, I could treat this. This is not terminal. However, I'm not willing to give free care. I charge a lot. And so he had this dilemma. Do I sign off and say she's terminal? Because to that doctor, she is terminal. To me, she's not terminal. And he ended up signing off that she is terminal. Wow. Now, to me, that she was exploited in a certain way, that she was just because she didn't have access to health care, that's a horrible story. So we were concerned, is this going to happen a lot? Are people at the end of life going to be treated because they're not valued by society in the same way and told, okay, you know, why should we fight for your life? Let's just end it. What we have found has not been that, though, actually, interestingly. We have found we keep careful data of who utilizes this. It's something like 90% are white. The vast majority have advanced degrees. And the vast majority are of upper social economic classes, which is fascinating. And it shows that it's really white, wealthy, well-educated people are doing this, which is a different problem because it shows that people who feel marginalized don't have the trust for the healthcare system that they're not engaging in this, right? Because you can understand why someone who doesn't trust the healthcare system might feel like, why should I trust you to end my life? Whereas wealthy people with better access are utilizing it. So there's already disparities happening, which is concerning. But it shows that the vulnerability argument that we were concerned about is not playing out as those who were concerned about it as they expected that it would play out.
Yehudit was waiting, but I want to just suggest that after Yehudit, maybe we'll take a break from unless this is what you want.
Well, then maybe we'll do this right. I'll get you learning. Yeah. Going. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
They at home, like you're saying, they're on hospice, but at home.
Right.
But they cannot, for whatever reason, do it themselves. But let's say the staff, the rabbi, or the medical staff, I guess the rabbi could be anybody, right? They have clear directives from this person, from
right.
before.
Right.
If that happens, this is what I want.
Right.
and the family member helps them. How do we look at this? Do we help them? Do we?
Are you asking like halachically? Okay, I'm actually going to talk about that. When we come back to it, I'm going to talk about their question, because there is like a lifnei iver question in terms of how much can you help them. A lot of people struggle with this, even separate from halacha, in terms of like, how can we make sure, because like I mentioned before with straws, how can we make sure that like they're the ones drinking it and not the person, so it's like not, so like keeping the letter of the law, so like can we put it next to them and put the straw into their mouth and then they have to move their head, and like it ends up becoming very gray and complicated. Here's one question, let me just share with you one question that I really struggled with. I'll give you the sources and then we'll come back and we'll learn together and we'll discuss more. So let's look at this Aruch HaShulchan together for a minute, because it builds up the question that we're going to have. In fact, let me tell you the question first, we'll look at the Aruch HaShulchan and then I'll stop and you'll learn. Here's the question. So after it became legal, I told you a few of the hard, difficult questions we had. Then we've had Orthodox from people that have done this. A lot of people have done it now in California, and including Orthodox people. And it has caused a lot of family strife. And so we had one patient, his family told him not to do it. They asked the rabbi to convince him not to do it. They told him, don't you know this is forbidden? He said, I know it's forbidden, and I don't care that it's forbidden. This is what I'm doing. They got him a psychiatric evaluation, and after the psychiatric evaluation, they said he's totally a clear mind. And despite him being a clear mind and being told by his rabbi and his family that it's forbidden and he shouldn't do it, he did it anyways. As soon as he did it, and he had all these warnings, he did it with his family was there in the hospital. It was like, and we called the Chevra Kedisha and said, okay, we have a difficult case. They said, okay, just send us over the death certificate and everything. They don't even write in the death certificate Aiden dying. They write the illness. But the Chevra Kedisha found out how this person had died, and they said to us, whoa, we can't take him. We can't bury him. So this led to a big tumult. So where did that come from? So let's just look at these together, and I'm going to build up the question even stronger, and then I'm going to stop and let you see if you can answer. Maybe the answer is just they were right. But let's see. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, Garsina B'Smachos, the Gemara in Smachos says, Ha'ma'abed Atzma L'das. That is the phrase for suicide in Talmudic, losing one's mind, basically. Ha'ma'abed Atzma L'das. Ein Mis'askim Bo Imo B'chol Davar. We are not allowed to be involved with them in any way. Divrei Rabbi Shmo. Omer, Korin Alav, you have to yell about them, Have Nitla, you're basically like cursing them. Oh, they were lost. You have to like not only not give them basic avelos and burial, you have to also kind of curse them. That was Rabbi Yishmael's opinion. Amrle Rabbi Kiva, he said, Hanach lo bestamo. Rabbi Kiva said, you know what, you don't have to curse them. Just al tachbideu velo tikalalehu. You don't honor them and don't curse them. You don't have to give them burial rites. Kolomar, dema'aved atzmo ladas avon gadolhu. It's a major sin. Ve'ein lo chelik leolam haba. They don't have a portion in olam haba. He argues. Next piece. I'm going to build up the question and drop more. He says v'shininu sham. Now what do we do? Ein korin alav. We can't tear kriya. Ve'ein chotin alav. Ve'ein maspidin alav. No hesped. Aval umdim alav b'shura. We could have the shuros for the nichum avelim, for the mourners. The omrim alav birchas avelim ibnesha hu kavod achayim, because that's for the living, for the mourners. Kol shel davar, the principle is kol shu kavod achayim, anything for honor for the living, for the descendants, or for the family, misaskim bo. We can do that. Kol shu ein kavod shel achayim ein harabim misaskim imo lechol davar. We can't do anything for the deceased. Now let's get specific. Now here's where you see where the Chevra Kedisha's, where their argument was in Sif Gimel. It says, Ochin Yisham, let's analyze, let's remember my story as we analyze this piece. Also is there in Smachos, Eze hu ha'ma'avid atzmo ladas. Who is considered to fit into this category halachically, right? So it's who fits into this category by halacha. So, lo sha'ala l'rosha ilan, it's not someone who goes to the top of a tree, v'naf of a mace, and falls and dies. Barosh ha'gag, or the top of a roof, v'naf of a mace. It only has to be ze sha'amar, Hareini ola l'rosha ilan. They have to announce, I'm going to do this. Or the Rosha Gag, I'm going to the top of the roof. The apilu atzmi, and I'm going to jump. So they tell you what they're doing, because otherwise, maybe you never know. They could have fallen by mistake. The amus, and then I'm going to die. The roino, and then you see them do it. Sh'alav enough of a mace. They go up, they fall, they die. Hareze bechezkas ma'avidas maladas. That is considered possibly ma'avidas maladas. Fein misaskin imo, and that we cannot be involved with. Matzu chanuk, but if you just find them strangled, v'talui be'ilan, or hanging from a tree, harug b'mushach al-gabi ha'saif, or just find them falling over a sword, like Shaul HaMelech, ein ze, lost my place, bechezkas ma'avidas maladas. That's not considered because you didn't hear them announce they're going to do it, you didn't see them do it, and so it's not enough. And you don't withhold anything from that person because you don't know exactly what they did, why they did it. There's a story, Maisa Benoshel. In fact, you know what? Let's save the rest. You can read that. We'll save that for when we come back because that's important. Going to be important. But now let's just think about this person that I just mentioned to you. So to be considered, so first of all, there's this concept that we don't bury someone who dies by suicide. But it's only if they say, this is what I'm going to do. You see them do it, and then it happens. How often could that happen? Well, our individual in the hospital, he said what he was going to do. He was warned. He was told it's not right by halacha. He had a psychiatric evaluation. He said he was declared to be competent. He then did it. We saw him do it, and then the chavrutisha said, I don't see any hetzer here to bury him. Yes.
Question. What do you then do with the, if you're not burying the body, what are you doing?
Well, you could theoretically, you know, allow them, because what they used to do is bury outside the Jewish cemetery. It's just, you don't give any of the rites, the Taharat HaChrichin, they just bury. There's a cemetery, someone told me, a rabbi in Cleveland told me that they actually did this at a cemetery in Cleveland, where outside in the outskirts of the cemetery, but not in their property, on the outside of the cemetery walls, they buried someone who died by suicide. And then years later, the cemetery expanded, and now the person's in the cemetery. So somehow God had compassion on that person, and now they're in the cemetery. But they're buried, but not in the Jewish cemetery with Jewish rituals. But we're going to come, don't worry, all this stuff we're going to come back to. I just want to bring the case, build up the case to you, and then the sources, I'll share with you. Well, yes, last couple questions then.
In general, what's the summer?
Well, in general, I guess maybe I should show it to you now because I don't want. I'll just show it to you now because, in general, what we say is look at the last piece in the Aruch HaShulchan there. He says the story there. It is an important story. You're right. I'll just say the story now. In general, when it comes to someone who dies by suicide, we say like if you continue with that story there, it said it's a really important story. It says Ma'aseh Benoshel Gornus Belud. There was this child in Lud, Shebarach mi beis ha-sefer. He ran away from school. He got in trouble in school. V'hara lo aviv be'ozno. And his father punished him horribly. His father, like, you can imagine.
His father threatened him.
Yeah.
His father went like this. I'm going to take you by the ear.
Right. Meaning, you can imagine that his father must have been someone who was a very strict father who potentially in the past had hurt him for doing bad things in school, right? Maybe he beat him or something like that. So his father's now warning him, Nisyari mi aviv. And he was very afraid of his father. And he went and he jumped into a pit and died. So now Ubo v'shalu as Rabbi Tarfon v'amar ein monin himenu kol davar. He said, "Can we bury him? He died by suicide. I thought you can't bury someone who dies by suicide." So he says, "No. In this case, mikanamru chachamim al yire adam. Don't hold anything back from him because you don't blame this kid. And that's why the rabbis then said al yire adam latinok beozno elam al keu miad. You can maybe punish them right away, but don't warn them, don't scare them, or yishtok, or just be quiet. Lo yomer lo klum. Don't say anything." Right, because always it should be yamin docha v'smol mikarev, yamin mikarev v'smol docha, and he says the main thing we see from this is that klalo shel davar, the last point there, because you asked, what do we normally do for someone who dies by suicide? Klalo shel davar b'avadat from the das talinan bechol ezehu talia kol shehu. We find some reason to say there must have been some psychological, psychiatric reason, just like this child. We didn't blame him. It's his father's fault. His father was abusive, and that's why he died. And so we don't say to him, you can't be buried, because we don't say it wasn't your fault. So the principle is, we always find some excuse to say it's not your fault, and we're allowed to bury.
But I feel like we're always in these hypotheticals. You can find a case where it's clear that the guy really wants to aid him and hasra, and like we never get that case.
Except this case. Right. So then we have the case. So that's why I want to stop here. Okay, fine. No, that's why I want to stop here. Right, different than physical suffering. Okay, good. So hold those, because what I want to do now, and we're going to come back. But so we had this question. So when the Kavadisha says this to me, so normally, you're right. Normally we say, anytime, and I've had much experience, as I'm sure many of us have, with people who died by suicide, and we never had this issue. We always bury them. We always give full honor to them, extreme compassion to their family, and we don't judge them or not critical in any way. And we never even suggest not giving them burial rites. But this time, when they said that to me, at first I was like, are you joking? Of course. What do you mean? We always find a reason to. And they said, but it's this. First of all, it was new to us. You have to give them that. It was totally new to us. Physician aid in dying was just become legalized. And they were like, this is the one time I don't think that there's a heter. So my role, I was like, okay, obviously I'm going to fight this, right? And rally up the other rabbis to we have to fight this. This can't be that we're not going to do this. Unless they wanted to argue, and I thought this might happen, the other rabbis might have said, you know what? We're shocked that a from Jew did this in a Jewish hospital. Like, we want the word to get out that we don't support this and that we want to scare people. Maybe I thought that was going to be their approach. And you know what? Maybe they're not going to let him be buried because in a Jewish cemetery, because they want to show the community this is new, it just became legal, and our community rejects it. So, but that's not how I felt, but I thought maybe that might, so I did some research. I came up with the following sources. We're going to talk about it more, but now take some time. We'll just do a half an hour. Like, I think there's plenty of time. Just do a half an hour of the sources that are on the sheet. It's just three sources. And if you have other sources, and we'll discuss it then, we'll come back, and then we'll really dig into the issue.
Jason, can you?
Yes.
Really quick. I think in England they say that at the last moment maybe they changed their mind, which could still apply.
Yeah, but at the last moment, he was very clear to the last moment why he was doing it. But
if you can take a look at people who are raising their hands who want, maybe you can come around to some of the chumrut
okay.
And have those
sure.
conversations. I know Ilan waited a long time and we never did.
Okay, I apologize. We'll make sure to get to it. So take some time, look at the sources to learn through them, debate it with yourselves. We'll come back and I want to hear your thoughts too. And then I'll share with you a few other insights that we've had in this issue and how we handled it. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed learning the sources. What we'll do now is I want to just go through what happened and then we'll discuss. Let me go through what happened and then also a few points. So I realized when this happened that this is going to be something that's going to be, you know, a controversy in our whole community and people are going to be talking about it and it's like a complicated issue. So I realized, first of all, I'm not the one that can just posket on this because it's the Chevra Kedisha Society. It's a communal organization, and we need to have communal buy-in. So I realized, first of all, I need to do research, and I need to ask Poskim. So one of those I spoke to was Rav Herschel Schechter. Rav Herschel Schechter quoted the following source. Now,
recording in progress.
Now let's look at this source, and it's a wild source that is very fascinating, very interesting if you haven't been exposed to it before, and also, you know, we'll have to discuss if it is relevant for our situation. So it's on the Beis Yosef on the bottom of the page there, where he is quoting the prohibition, Aches Dimchem Lenashosechem Edrosh, the prohibition against suicide. In fact, we had a nice translation. I kind of said, speedily running through the sources before, I translated it, Ma'abed Atzmo L'das. I think I just said losing one's mind, but we had a much better way of translating those words. How did you say it? I liked how you said it.
Doing yourself in knowingly.
Uh-huh. Doing oneself in knowingly is a nice, much, much more eloquent way of translating the words. So when based on that prohibition and also on the issue of, you know, the Gemara quotes, you could have assumed that it could be like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, but the Ach, there is a teacher that in Shas HaShemad, maybe you could allow for someone to end their life, especially if it's done by someone else. So then we have this issue that came up during the Crusades and horrible times of Jewish persecution when Jews had to make horrible decisions about their children. You can imagine horrible things like this in the Holocaust when someone's hiding under their house and the Nazis come looking for them and their baby's crying and they have to decide, is my whole family going to get caught or do I snuff the baby's, you know, ability to cry but possibly killing the child?
You can think about this on October 7th.
A lot of cases, exactly. Very relevant, very recent.
Isn't the Marsham Tshuva
about that? Yeah, so we're going to come to that. So
October 7th is different. This is Jews killing their babies.
Yeah. No, same thing. If a terrorist is in your house.
You're hiding and
they're terrorists around, then you don't.
And they're looking for you. Can you kill your own baby? Your own baby, in order to not get caught.
Bomb shelter.
Or if you know that they're going to shoot your baby,
right?
You have to do it,
and you do right. And this is even more though. This was a different question. This was the question of if they're going to convert your child. Not just that they're going to cut your family, but you don't want your child to get converted. So look at what he says here. So he says, "Umikan mivin raya hashochtim hatinokos b'shas hashmad." This could be a proof for those who killed children in a time of forced conversions. V'yesh osrim umeforshim hach. Some say no, that's not allowed, and that's when it says ach tamad lomar ach she'enu yachol la'arog atzmo. They say no, that's only to say that you can't kill yourself. V'chanim shal nezaria masu atzim biyad acherim. They let other people do it for them, but they didn't do it themselves. Aval heim lo pagu ba'atzim. They didn't kill themselves. V'shol ben kishon. What about Shaul HaMelech? He killed himself. Shelo beratzon hachachamim asa. He did it without the permission of the rabbis. So we'll see different opinions later about that. But then he tells a story. Umais, and there was actually, this happened. This is part of the reality of Jewish history. I often say we're talking about chaplaincy. I often joke, I did my master's when I was here at Yeshiva University in at Revel in Jewish history. I often joke, I went into chaplaincy because Jewish history is too depressing. But chaplaincy compared to that is not depressing. So we have this reality in our history. So what happened? There was a maisa, a story, Berav Echad, with a rabbi. It was the rabbi's job. Can you imagine this? Sheshachat Tinokos Harbe, who went around killing Jewish children. He felt that this was his role at that time. Shachat Tinokos Harbe. He killed many. Bishasa Shemad.
This is the choice of the words of Shachat. Is deliberate.
Yeah, he slaughtered them.
So evocative.
So he killed and many of them. Bishasa Shemad at a time of persecution, religious persecution. But why? Not because he was afraid of Nazis upstairs and he was hiding in the attic. She yare she avirum al hadas. They were afraid that they were going to be converted. Better kill them than let them be converted out. V'haya imo rav acher. But there's another rabbi. Imagine the machlokas we have now. Oh, you hold the Torah Mishnah, you hold this, you hold that. They were fighting over should you be killing Jewish children or not. I mean, this is a real fight. And you can imagine how heated this must have gotten. Because it says, haya imo rav acher, there's another rabbi with him, v'kasalav, and he got angry. And I can imagine this wasn't just like, hey, I don't agree with you. I mean, it was probably quite the machlokas. V'kasalav, v'karu rosteach, and he said, you are a murderer. V'hulo chashal devarav, he said, yeah, I'm not concerned. I don't think I am. I'm doing the right thing. Lo chashal devarav, v'amar harav amoneah, so the one who said you shouldn't be doing this said, Imka devarai, if what I'm saying is right, yiharog oso rav bemisa mishuna. You will die a horrible death. And that will be my proof that I was right. And guess what? V'chein haya. And it happened. Shetavshu goyim v'hayu poshtim oro. I'm not going to read the description. They killed him and they tortured him. So this is apparently one opinion. Now, when I asked Rav Schechter, Rav Hirsch Schechter, about our case, about the man who died by suicide, by physician aid in dying in the hospital, saying he knew what he was doing, and he knew it was prohibited, and he had the psychiatric evaluation, he said he was about to do it, and he had witnesses, and they were there when he did it, and he did it, can we bury him? So when I asked Rav Schechter, he said, I don't rely on the opinion of the Urchos Chaim that's quoted there. I don't think it's halakhically right. However, I think you could rely on it, b'dieved, in a case like this, and say, we can rely on it after the fact to give him burial rights. So there's that opinion. That's one possibility. I asked some other rabbis, and I had different opinions. In fact, before that, there was a source that I found when I was looking. I found the following source, and you'll tell me if you notice the problem with the source. The Piskei Tshuva. So I came across this. I thought, done. Once I found this and I read this, I was like, this is our case. This is proof. This is fine. Ayin B'tshuvos B'samim Rosh. Okay, maybe it's already over. But... So you know the B'samim Rosh, right? Written by the Rosh, right? That's the big important Rishon, right? K'zavim HaRosh. It is possible. Well, we'll see. So he says, what did he write there? Shekasa be'echad chaser lechem v'chashuv shas. So someone was just very, very poor. Shalach b'fnei shnayim. He went in front of two witnesses. V'amar ma'asi b'chayai. My life is lost meaning. V'abad atzmo. And he ended his life. T'enu nikra me'abad atzmo z'das. But that's not considered suicide halachically. Why? Because he did it out of tsar, daga, and yisurim. Or onigam, or even poverty, is enough of a reason. Ayin Shamv Ayin Besefer Har Eva Anath Echad Asar She Pikpek Alav Ba Vekasav Delav Gushpanka Der Rush Chatim Mara. He said, this does not feel like the Rush would have written this. And if we know, it's a massive controversy if we can rely on B'samim Rosh. There are post-game Rav Avadya many times who actually use B'samim Rosh, but it's mostly considered to be a forgery. And this is one of those things that the rabbi said, some things he wrote in there maybe are accurate, but other things, it just seems like there was an agenda, and they didn't accept this. And in fact, when I saw this, and I sent it to some of our rabbanim in Los Angeles, I said, can we rely on this source? They said, you know, I'm not comfortable relying on the B'samim Rosh for this. And they said, no. One last, I asked Rav Asher Weiss, and he pointed me to this Marsham. The Marsham now deals with Shaul HaMelech. Before, we pointed out that, in Orchos Chaim, he said, Shaul HaMelech was Shaloh Kedas Chachamim, that was his Lashon, right? Lo Baratzon Chachamim. He was not in accordance with the rabbis. But the Ramban, you see, I underlined there, but the Hevi Shema Ramban, Shekasav, Deshol Yadami Pia Navi Sheragohu, that he knew he was going to get killed. The Hosif Beard, the E Bishvil Chayisha, maybe because of Chayisha. Alzei Samach Li Natzel Mi Yisurim, so he did this to avoid the pain and suffering that would have been caused by being murdered by the Plishtim, probably being paraded and tortured. And so he writes, if you look in the next paragraph, Al Kopanim Ladina Yafa Kiven De'im Asa Kein Mipnei Yisurim Mekadoma, if it's because of pain and suffering, Einenu Bechal Me'abed Atzmo L'das. So that might not be Me'abed Atzmo L'das. In fact, that might even be a category that you've probably learned if you learned Hilchos Shabbos yet. Like the Binyan Tzion, Halak came to Nehid the Aser, even though it's prohibited, Al Pi Adin, technically it's prohibited, Mikol Makom, Mechashev Ke Omer Mutter. But the person, because of their the justifications they made in their mind, they said to themselves, it's allowed. And so, even though they might have transgressed the prohibition, from their perspective, they did not. He concludes, based on the Ramban, and the truth is, this person, he was Chayisha, right, to have been doing this legally by California laws we discussed before. Clearly he was terminal. He knew his death was coming. So he concludes here, B'shem Ramban, D'mishum Chayisha, Mutter Mishum Tsar, V'yisurim La'abed Atzmo, et Atzmo. Because of the pain and the suffering, V'akoponim Yesholmer, D'havik Omer Mutter. At least he was like someone who said to himself that it is Mutter.
I just want to add that the Maharsham felt, I actually don't know what to say, what Sfarim were available, but the case of Shaul and being an exculpating Shaul, saying that he was okay, goes back to Chazal. You find it in Rishon Rabbah and in Smachot, like a lot of different places.
Yeah.
This is like a solid thing. It's
look at this.
Ramban didn't make it up.
Right, for sure. Look at, go back to that Aruch HaShulchan that we read before. I purposely skipped one line. So after we said that the principle always is, when people die by suicide, that always the principle in halacha is that we make some kind of psychiatric or psychological evaluation, that we just say they must have regretted it the last second, or they weren't doing...
According to what it says on Seif Da and Seif, it's almost impossible to say that there wasn't anything.
Right, except for that's what I was trying to argue, that in our case it seemed like that was the one case. But then he says here, because when he mentioned Shaul, and it's interesting the way he mentioned Shaul, I think it was in Sif Hei, right?
Yeah, right at the end.
Yeah. So after he said Kol Shadavar that you always do, so he says, so you say that the person is suffering, or Shesavar Shehai is a mitzvah the Belili Kashel Be'averus Acheres, they're doing it because they don't want to do another Avera. Ukiyotze Be'elu HaDavar Mipnei Shezeu Be'emes Davar Rachok She'adam Yasei Navala Kazu.
Like a wild, he's like,
yeah,
really,
he can't imagine someone would do this.
But like, he's saying
BMS,
but he doesn't mean
BMS,
but he means like,
yes, I agree. I mean, it's interesting, Lashon, that he says there, but then he says, how could it be that they did it clearly? Selah made me Shaul HaTzadik, which is already interesting, especially if you learn Sefer Shmuel. I mean, was Shaul HaTzadik, but all of a sudden, he's the hero, Shaul HaTzadik. I've heard of Yosef HaTzadik. I've heard of the Orchos, the Shaul HaTzadik. Yeah, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh.
If you look in Chazal, what Chazal say about Shaul is, especially, in Perek Chelek, they talk a lot about Shaul, about being like this fantastic person, and a lot of this, Rabbi Reznikov said a lot of this exculpating of Shaul HaMelech comes from like this mindset of Shaul being like this great tzaddik and Torah scholar and stuff like that. So it cannot be that he would do something
wrong.
Halacha, so it has to be that it was fine.
Uh-huh. Well, so he concludes, right? So he concludes. So he says, if you look, go and learn from Shalat Tzadik, Shanafa Acherbo, Leblidis Alelubo, HaPlishtim, so he wouldn't be tortured by them. Kiyotze Bezei Mikre Ones. That's considered Ones, Koshkin, Katan, Avadats, Madas, Techashuv, Kishalo, Ladas. Now, this, what we saw here in this Marsham and this and in the Archa Shulchan, because when he's that. Because he also said in Sif Dalid, there was one line there. Lashon that he uses, but the line of tsar and daga. So this man. So I mentioned to you that the family wanted me to meet with him and see if I could convince him, which I failed at. But one thing he said to me, and it was a challenge. You know, it's my age. You know, I'm in my mid-40s, but he was in his late 80s. And at one point, he says to me, I said to him, you know. I don't remember exactly what I said, but I was talking to him and he saw that maybe I was trying to help him think about it thoroughly. And he says to me, you know, it's nice of you to talk to me, Rabbi, but you're a young man. You have your whole life ahead of you. You don't know what I'm going through right now. You don't know what it's like to be me. If you could imagine the amount of pain I'm in, and you know that I know that I'm dying soon and I'm suffering, and please don't judge me, because the amount of suffering I am experiencing is not something that you can relate to right now. And you simply can't relate to it. And it's real. It's real and it's horrible, and you should never know of it. Wow. And I thought about that after, because, you know, in this Marsham, he does say that, you know, Tsar, Yisurim, we're not just talking about physical pain. Obviously, there's pain and there's suffering. He was suffering. He was suffering existentially. He knew what he was doing, but it wasn't Omer Mutter. I mean, it was exactly this category. And once, you know, we started discussing this amongst the Rabbanim in Los Angeles, not that I was a decision maker. Once they discussed it, but we really, like, pushed the issue. And we went to our Chevra Gadisha and we said, you know, I think you have to reconsider. First of all, we had a number of post-game outside of Los Angeles that we consulted with. They thought we should do this. Our Rabbanim here thought we should do this. And the family was suffering so much, you can imagine. They were already trying to convince him. They're already extremely embarrassed. We did have the consideration that maybe, you know, this is new in California and throughout the United States now. Maybe we should make a macha and show that, like, we're not accepting this and that we should set the Migdar Milsa. But at the end of the day, you know, we felt that compassion should guide us in this. And so he did. He got full burial rights, like as if anyone else. It was no different. And he was buried in a Jewish cemetery.
Susan,
can you tell us? Hi, this is Susan.
I'm going to call out people's names as we go.
Great. What was the time frame that this all took place in?
Very quickly, in like 2 days. It basically didn't delay his funeral.
Adam.
Jack just said you could, but you ever rely on the Beit Yosef, right?
He said you don't rely on the Beis Yosef, except for something like this, to provide burial rights. You can say, you know what, B'dieved, we'll rely on that, at least to give him the burial rights, to say he has one opinion out there that saved him.
But does it mean, I thought the Beis Yosef was saying it's fine as long as someone else does it to you, and this kid in American law, unlike in Canada, had to do it this to himself.
Yeah. So
it doesn't work with the Beis Yosef, no?
Well, the one opinion of the Beis Yosef that did say you could do it.
Oh, okay, I must have missed that. I thought Beis Yosef was saying it was only okay if someone does it to you.
Right, I mean, that was the implication of from Chana Mishal Nazaria.
He said that you could, and the Beis Yosef disagrees with him.
Ah, okay, right. Thank you.
I see.
So the other, oh, yes.
Ilana? Yes, hi. Quick question based on Aruch HaShulchan. He seems to say that there is a possibility even somebody who says, I will take my life in this manner, but then you don't see them do it, and then you come and you find them and you can't presume anything.
Right.
Is that a possibility just to be no witnesses at that moment? So then it's like as if you don't know what happened and then...
Right, theoretically, someone brought that up. You're right. I mean, if we were going to get like very halachic, you know, formalistic about it, we could have said to the family, okay, step out of the room for a second so we can have funeral. So just step out and don't, or look away, don't see it. But I don't know. First of all, we weren't thinking that at the time. And also, there is a loss there too, because the person wanted to have his family with him. I don't know. It's also, even the Aruch HaShulchan, when his Koin Tzmachos, he didn't actually say you have to see every aspect of it. You have to just see that. They say, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what then happened. Like, do you have to witness every part of it? I don't know if that was part of the requirement.
Oh, I actually did get that out of it.
Yeah, okay, maybe.
That you have, like the Chasam Sofer is very right. You have to actually see
you
it.
You have to watch the guy go from the top to the bottom.
Right.
Unbroken line of sight.
Right. So, okay, theoretically, we could have said, first of all, we didn't know this was going to happen, that we're going to have this problem until afterwards.
That's weird.
Theoretically, you could do it. It is a little weird. It is a little strange, but theoretically, you can make the argument.
But there is, like, in one source, maybe the Chasam Sofer, there's a locked room.
situation where he says,
right.
And whatever, and you go in and you find him dead, and it's clear that he set it up himself, like nothing.
Right, because he didn't see it. Right. Thank you. Well, I just want to bring up one other issue that came up, and then I want to start to wrap up. So some things that we learned from this. One other issue came up for us that we weren't anticipating until Wright became new, which was that there is a requirement in many states, especially in Canada. Canada, they call it effective referral. There's a requirement to, let's say a doctor or any healthcare provider isn't comfortable with this physician aid in dying. But a patient comes to them and says, you know, do I fit the rules? Am I allowed to do this? What if the doctor who says, I don't want to do this, can they give a referral? Can they be involved in any aspect of it? Can, you know, in what ways can they just say, I can't say it, I'm not allowed to say anything? So I just want to share with you one interesting sock that we got.
Wait, could you clarify that a little?
Yeah, leave the iver. Meaning, if someone's going to, let's say this patient I'm talking about, he's going to do it anyways. So he comes to his doctor, he goes to his physician, let's say he starts with his primary care physician, who he's known for his whole life, and he's an Orthodox Jew, and he says, doctor, can you, the law is I have to make a request from my physician, and you have, you start on the process. Does the doctor now, this observant Jewish doctor, does he have to help him along the process? He's not going to be giving it to him, but does he have to make the referral? Or even if he says, I'm not willing to do it, but I know a doctor down the hall who will do it, let me send you to him. Can he do that even? Or does he have to say, by halacha, if we're going to say this is forbidden, does he have to say, I'm sorry, I can't do anything now. I can't help you in any way. I can't talk about it. Like what happens in many red states. I mean, I'm not trying to make it political, but those states where abortion is now legal, like as many of those who are opposed to it say, like, I won't even make a referral. Right? I won't even put a flyer in my office, whatever. They won't, pharmacists that won't give medications, right? Things like that. So this was a question that came up for us. For many doctors, especially when it was new, it was really scary for people. What am I going to do? So we actually brought Rav Asher Weiss to speak to our doctors. He came out, and I was shocked by what he said. So that's what I want to share. So he said, he got up, it was like 300 doctors. He said, not only can you make a referral, not only can you be involved with these patients, I think you should be involved with them. I was like, what? So here was his explanation. And it reminded me of a similar psalm that he once gave me that I just thought was so beautiful. I want to share with you as I start to wrap up. But one of the big questions in chaplaincy, it's just related with Lifnei Iver, is I get the following call. This happens almost every day. Rabbi, the patient in such and such room is going to be terminally extubated. They're dying. Their family is gathering. They want the rabbi to come say a prayer first. What kind of time can you come? So we can tell the family to be there, and we'll tell the respiratory therapist to be there at that time. So if you're available at 2, the patient dies at 2. If you're available at 4, the patient dies at 4.
Oh, wow.
So just, you know, so then the question is, like, can I go? What if it's a case where, from a halachic perspective, let's say from my opinion, this case would not be that it's permissible to extubate. Can I go there and be the chaplain? So actually I asked this to Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz Zatzal once. He said, you're a chaplain. He's like, you're there to be the chaplain, not the posek. So when you show up to the room, you're there not saying, I agree with what you're doing. You're there saying, I agree that this is hard for you, whatever it is, and I'm here to provide emotional pastoral care. And that, whatever they're doing, you can provide pastoral support. I thought that was a beautiful answer. One posek I asked said, you can't go. You have to quit your job. He literally said, you can't do it. If that's your job, you can't do that. Just like there's a story of Rav Chaim that someone in his shul, in his community, was convicted of a capital offense, and he asked for his last wishes to see his rabbi. So he came into the shul and said, Rabbi, we need you now. The authorities came in. The police came in and said, Rabbi, come with us to the jail. You know, someone's being executed. They asked for your bracha first. And he said, okay, I'll be there soon. And they came back an hour later and said, yeah, I'm coming. Don't worry. The next day they came to the rabbi. We're waiting for you. He said, oh yeah, I'll come later. And basically he kept pushing them off until they actually just killed the person. But he said, just like Rav Chaim wouldn't go, you can't go. So I asked Rav Asher Weiss. He said he had someone in his community, a young Hasidish teenager who had horrible epilepsy and horrible illnesses, and he was confined to a wheelchair and on a trach, and he had a horrible life. He had a lot of suffering. And he said he once asked for the rabbi, Rav Asher, to come see him in his house. He comes and sees him. He sits down with him. And he says, Rabbi, I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. And I need to confide in you that I'm ending it. I'm having the trach pulled out, after which I will die right away. But of course, I need your heter. I need you to tell me that it's allowed.
Wow.
So he said, gosh, I felt horrible for him. I said, I can't tell you that it's allowed what you're doing. I feel horrible, but I can't say it's mutter. So the young man said to him, don't worry, I knew you were going to say that. I knew you'd say it's not allowed. So I'm asking you to daven for my neshama after I do it, because I am going to do it. Just daven for my neshama. That's all I'm asking. So he said, I realized, he trapped me a little bit, because if I say I'm going to daven for your neshama, I'm kind of giving him permission. If I say I'm not going to daven for your neshama, what kind of a person am I? How could I say no to this kid who's suffering? So he said, I realized, you know, especially when someone is in a struggling, you know, difficult psychological state, you never know how they'll react. If I say no to him, it's going to be so cruel. If I say yes, I'll daven for you, who knows what impact that will have, that his rabbi at least showed compassion. So I said to him, of course I will daven for you. I'll daven for you every day. And he started crying, as he said. And he said, the young man said, it means so much to me. When he told me that story, he said, it's been 3 years, and he hasn't done it. And he said, he said, you should go. Here's why you should go to your patients when they call you for this. He said, most times, they're going to do it anyways. But sometimes they're going to say to you, okay, Rabbi, now we see, by the way, that you came and you're with us in this time. You didn't come and judge us. You didn't come and condemn us. You're compassionate. You're with us. Rabbi, you know, we're planning on cremating. What do you think about that? Or is there any other options? And you'll be able to say, like, oh, you know, actually we have a fund that we can pay for burial. You said the prayers. You can have a positive impact on being there. You never know how someone's going to react when a rabbi is harsh and judgmental. But they will oftentimes react much better when you are positive, embracing, welcoming. That's why you should be there. By the way, just as a side point, I know I'm already in a side point, but in one more side point, then I'll get back to the main point, then I'll get to your comment, which is that in Oregon, they found, Oregon's where they studied this issue the most, right? And we look to Oregon because it's been legal there for 30 years. You know that most people who receive this eight and nine drugs don't do it. Anyone want to guess, by the way, when they ask in Oregon, why are you doing this? What's the number one reason why people end their lives by cessation aid and dying?
They just want to know that they can.
Exactly. Everyone assumes it's depression. They don't want to be a burden. The number one reason they give is they want to have control. Right. Especially when you're at a time in your life, and we should not know of it. When a person is in a time in their life, when they have a terminal illness, they're suffering. Their doctors, the medical staff is constantly doing things at them, to them. They're just an object. And they have no control over their destiny. If they get these drugs, they now have control again. And for many people, that's enough. They just needed the control. They can do it if they need to, but they don't. And so about half, used to be actually 60%, don't end up doing it. So in Oregon, one of the studies, I have this study in my book, I'm happy to share with any of you. I thought it was a really brilliant study. They asked the people who, you know, in between the time of them applying for it and then doing it, so they did all these surveys. They asked them, do you have religious clergy? Those who said yes, then they said, is your clergy compassionate and embracing of you, or have they been judgmental and rejecting of your decision? Those whose clergy were compassionate and accepting were less likely to do it. Those whose clergy rejected them or were judgmental of them were more likely to end their lives this way, meaning they felt rejected anyways. So it's like, even if you say, I oppose physician aid in dying, possibly being compassionate and embracing and kind is actually, even strategically, I'm not saying that we should do it strategically because that's not true compassion, but I'm just saying, even if you have a strategic view. So then going back now, talking to our staff, so Rav Asher Weiss said, so why am I telling you that you should do it? He said, if you're opposed to this, if you think this is a bad thing for medicine, that anyone who's, you know, is ill, we're just going to say to them, you know, just end your life. If you think that's bad, then don't leave it just to those doctors who are advocates for it, who think like, oh, it's a great thing to do. Let's just end all our, I'm not saying there's anyone who says this, but let's just end. There should be moral diversity. If you want to have moral diversity, you should be involved. I'm not saying that you should necessarily be the ones, in many ways in California, it has to be self-ingested, but I'm not saying you're allowed to, like, for example, I remember a nurse raised her hand. She said, this isn't relevant for me. I'm an anesthesiologist. And I'm a nurse anesthetist, but I'm involved with abortion frequently. So in Judaism, abortion is often allowed, but in those cases where it's not, she said, can I provide anesthesia for an abortion? And he said, what role are you playing there? You're providing comfort for a person. Like, in what way would it be forbidden to provide comfort? This is not lifnei iver. It's not even messiah. There are postcards that say providing anesthesia for an abortion is prohibited. But he said maybe to actually be the one to do the act in a case where it would be forbidden, that would be a problem. But to be involved with the action, to provide compassion. So he said to the doctors, I think you should be involved. Be there for your patients. Talk through things with them and let them make their decisions. But you should be there. And maybe throughout the process, by having someone who thinks about it in a nuanced way, they'll have different options. And they won't necessarily make that decision.
I think Amanda.
Oh, yes, Amanda.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Two questions. First, I'm wondering, I guess this is a bit of a step back, but we've talked about the ideal of being buried in a Jewish cemetery as, like, a given, and I'm wondering if you can speak to, like, why is that a given? Like, why is that such a priority for people that they want to be buried in a Jewish cemetery? Does it have to do more with, like, the preparation, the tahara, and that kind of thing? Or is there something, like, inherently about being buried in a Jewish space that is really important? And second of all, in the story that you just told, there was an idea of, like, that you shouldn't daven for someone because that would be permissive in some way. Is that due to the fact that we said that, like, that person should be cursed? Or, like, what is the permission in that you're giving by davening for someone's neshama?
Well, just to go a second first, the implication of davening for someone is to say, like, even if you do this act, I'm still with you. I'm still supporting you. I'm still being kind to you. It kind of implies that I don't really condemn what you did. If I believed what you did was evil, I wouldn't daven for you because in that supportive way, because I would be more likely to condemn you and say, I think that you're a Russia. You're a horrible person. So, like, that's why he felt that davening for the person's neshama was kind of implied support. And being buried in a Jewish cemetery is considered to be a big schus for the neshama. You know, we have this concept of ein kovrin rasha leitzel tzaddik, or people want to be buried next to their community, next to people that are similar to them, whether that's, you know, it's just a schus for their neshama. So it's also, you know, part of the communal, throughout Jewish history, this is actually very relevant in another topic which we won't go into now, but cremation. We see this, that in Jewish history, a lot of ways, truth is not just Jewish history, in Christian, in the church as well, very, very much. The way the community holds their authority, one of the ways is through their cemeteries. If we let you into our cemetery, that's how we show who we accept in our community. So when they at first didn't allow burial of cremains, of people who are cremated, that was their way of saying, we don't accept this, therefore if we don't let you in our cemetery, you're like not part of our community. Because we are excluding you to show what we allow and what we don't allow. And so this is our way of imposing communal norms. Today we have very little way, like in Europe, they had a lot of ways of doing that. We have very little way. You know, someone could say, okay, I'm going to go to a different shul. Like, I don't, but the cemetery is some way that we can still, in some aspects, control the Jewish community. So that was part of a way of saying, like, if you're part of the community or not, I think those are the implications of it. Interesting question.
I just wanted to point out that the claim that Rosenbacher made is the same claim that the professor made, the Canadian professor made at the beginning of the.
Yeah, the. Mm-hmm.
The claim that Rav Asher of Weiss made, that taking a supportive attitude is pikuach nefesh, is the same claim that the Canadian professor made for legalization of euthanasia. It's pikuach
nefesh. Right, I mentioned at the beginning. Right, exactly, that's right.
Did Rabbi Weiss take a stand on the question of referring to a doctor that would help you?
Yeah, he said you could.
He said you could.
You could, yeah. Yeah, you can't, he just said, you can't do the action, but anything leading up, anything short of doing the action, you could do.
Even referring to a doctor.
Yeah, even making the referral. Okay. Yeah. So I'll just close with, you know, we see it's a complicated issue, and there's very strong emotions involved. Even if a person feels that this is something that's prohibited halakhically, and it's clearly, you know, very, there are a lot of problems, halakhic problems, but it is very possible and appropriate to have compassion, even for someone who's doing something that you might not agree with. We saw already Shaul HaMelech, even though there were those who condemned what he did, but there was many of those who tried to find limud zchus. In fact, if you just one last verse, I'm just going to quote as I conclude, on page 45 of your source sheets, this is for the next year, but I'm actually not going to read it then anyways, is in Mincha Shlomo, Chelik Aleph Simon Tzadi Aleph, he says something very interesting that bothered me for a long time because I didn't understand it. And then with this issue, it kind of hit me all of a sudden. He says as follows. He says, Nir Lenius Daiti, Shefilu ima chola mitzdair harbe, a patient who's in a lot of pain, ba'ofen kazeh shemitzada alacha mitzvah levakesh alav shiyamus. Just like we saw yesterday, the run, that a patient who's dying and suffering, that you could pray for them to die. So you have a patient who's suffering and dying, and you can pray for them to die. Even while you're davening for their death, out of compassion, kvar shekasav aran, mikol makom gam ba'osa shah, at that same time, shemavakesh mispal la'ashem she'achola yamus, that they die, gam kein chayev hulis asik pat salato. You are, at the same time, you can act to save their lives. Ulachalal alav es ha-shabbos, afilu kamav amim. You can break, so they collapse at home. You can get in your car and drive them to the hospital on Shabbos, breaking Shabbos, while you want them to die. You can want someone to die because that's in their best interest. You want to be compassionate to them while you're still allowed to break Shabbos to save their life. In other words, you're holding two things, contradictory things in your head at once. So it's possible to say, I think that this action is halachically problematic. And I have tremendous compassion for the person who's going through this. And nothing but rachmanos, compassion, solidarity. I'm there with it. Imo anochi betzara. And it's not all about, you know, depression. It's, you know, people need someone to listen to them, just hear them out. There's even some of that research from Oregon showed just the impact of doctors, the amount of time they spend just listening, just being there, helping them to feel a sense of control over their situation, a sense of what's happening, when's it going to happen. We had, and I'll conclude the story and we'll stop. But just to illustrate that, we had once a young woman, and I apologize, I should say trigger warning. We had Rabbi Yoni Rosenzweig, we hosted him at our hospital a few weeks ago, and he got up to speak and he goes, I know that nowadays it's important to give a trigger warning before you say something very, very, you know, triggering. He's like, whenever I speak, I am one big trigger warning. So let me just tell you right now, if you're listening to me, I am a trigger warning. You're now, so anyways, So this story is just a difficult story, but I think it illustrates the point well. And it's sort of a young woman who was dying in our hospital, and she was very depressed. She was in her 30s. She had a small child. She was dying, and the staff was giving her depression medications and trying to like convince her to cheer up, and it wasn't working. And finally, thankfully, they called in the chaplains. So we went to see her, and a chaplain's role is to listen. I just want, when I sit in with a patient, my goal is just tell me more. Tell me what's going on. I want to know who you are, what matters for you, what's going on with you. It's not my place to talk. I'm just listening and trying to help you articulate yourself. And she became very clear. All I can think about is that my daughter won't know her mother. My daughter will grow up not knowing who I am, what was important to me, what my values are. She'll never know her mother. And that's just destroying me. So I suggested to her, have you ever heard of an ethical will? So she's like, no, what's that? So, and I know you're going to all be doing this. So I said, well, let's create, I'll write it. I could write it for you if you want. I have prompts of like 10 questions that help you describe your values, your legacy, who you are, what matters to you. Let's create a document that will be a gift for your daughter. And she got really excited about it. In fact, we made a video. Let's let her see you talking. And let's make like a video diary of the next few days. She started all of a sudden perking up, participating in her care, eating, sleeping normally. I'm not saying she became happy-go-lucky. She died only a few months later. But it gave her a sense of purpose. And it was like, to just say to someone like, oh, she's depressed, just give her depression medications. It's too easy and not effective. But to actually give people a sense of, let me hear what matters for you right now. Let's show compassion, be there for you, and recognize that, yes, halachic issues arise, and our rabbis have dealt with them before. And so we'll deal with halachic issues. They'll sometimes guide us in different ways, but they'll help us to show compassion, especially for patients who care about halacha, and they want to know that there's a halachic approach. That family who we ended up bearing, you know, their father, their grandfather, they were happy to see that it was based on Mar Makomos and sources. It wasn't just like we said to them, oh, we feel bad for you, so we'll just do it. They said, oh, you know what? There's basis for this. We feel embraced by our community, and so we feel a sense of comfort. So these are very difficult decisions, but as I mentioned at the outset, it's legal now in 11 states, but it's coming, it's on legislature in 20 states this year, and it's increasing, and so it's something to be aware of and to be thinking about our role in this.
Can I ask